Welcome to the Jacob's Well podcast. These messages are intended to feed you some great stuff that you can really dig your teeth into all week and beyond. That's why you can find it anytime, along with other great resources and ways to keep the conversation going at jacobs-well.net/leftovers. Enjoy the message.
Welcome. As you probably saw from the trailer, we're going to be talking about the Book of Life, which happens to be this story about these three kids, these three best friends, somewhere in a small village in Mexico, Manolo, Joaquin, and Maria, who, even though they're best friends, Manolo and Joaquin find themselves in love with the same girl, the spunky, smart, and beautiful Maria. And so basically the movie is about which Manolo or Joaquin is going to win the hand of Maria. So that's kind of like on the surface what this movie is about. But I also think there's something a lot more interesting going on in this movie, which is why I wanted to talk to you about it today. So underneath this sort of familiar, simple love story, There's a deeper meaning, a deeper message. So one of the first things you notice when you watch this movie is that it's clearly about a celebration of Mexican heritage and culture and history. But at the same time, you also notice that you've got these old-timey mariachi bands playing these decidedly modern and non-Mexican songs by the likes of Radiohead and Mumford & Sons and my personal favorite, Biz Markie. Basically, what the movie is really trying to ask us, aside from this love story, is sort of, as a culture and as individuals and as a society, how do we honor and remember our past without letting it enslave our future? And that's really what's kind of going on with the movie. And I think it's an important message that we often wrestle with here at Jacob's Well, that we want to pay tribute to this heritage, whether it's religious or cultural or whatever, that we all came from. But we also want to make progress, whether in our lives or as a society. And so how do we kind of deal with this tension? So we'll see if maybe you see the same thing as I go through the message today. So in this very first scene that we're going to watch, you're going to see the independent and rebellious young Maria makes a decision that she simply can't bear to see these helpless, innocent little pigs fall under the butcher's knife. And so she makes the decision that she's going to set them free, which, noble as it is, has some unintended consequences. So let's watch the scene and see what happens.
Maria, what have you done now?
Retreat, no surrender.
He has the gift. Mijo. That's my son.
Oh, thank you, Manolo.
Oh, my. What did I miss?
You okay, sir?
You have saved my life.
And I...
Shh! Quiet, boy. I'm talking.
But I...
Quiet. What? That girl is in so much trouble.
Uh-oh.
Maria!
I'm sorry, Papa. It's just that I...
Manolo's guitar.
Maria! This rebellious nonsense ends now! You are going to become a proper lady!
Why?
Because I said so! I'm sending you to Spain. The sisters at the convent of the Perpetual Flame of Purity will straighten you out.
What? But Papa!
No, it is decided. Now go home! Joaquin, you are so much like your father. This town could use a new hero. Come. You are like the son I never had. My boy, your father was like a brother.
Epa, where do you think you're going?
He can't send Mario away.
Well, fathers do what's best for their children. Come along. Mio, I saw how you fought that beast. You made our ancestors proud.
You think Maria was impressed?
Maria and every girl in town. People said I was the greatest bullfighter in our family's history. But it is you, my son, who will be the greatest Sanchez ever. They will write songs about you.
And I will...
So, other than Maria getting sent away to boarding school, things are kind of looking up for our heroes here. So on the one hand, you've got Joaquin, who seems to be following in the footsteps of his brave and heroic father, the town hero who gave up his life defending the town from this evil bandit, Chacal. And if you notice, when the general was talking to him, he was literally standing under the shadow of the statue in the center of town of his father. Symbolism, anyone? And then you've got Joaquin, on the other hand, who decides in this family lineage of bullfighters, he's going to go out there and he's going to fight this bull. And it turns out he's really good at it. His father says he has the gift. And so he's tickled that his father is so proud of how courageous and skillful that he is. So much so that his father thinks, well, you could be the greatest Sanchez ever. Only problem is Manolo doesn't want to be a bullfighter. In fact, he wants to be a musician, a mariachi, to be specific. And so what you have here is this tension that Manolo's facing all through growing up, where he's got this, on the one hand, he's being urged to do what his heart is telling him to do versus the expectations of his family and his culture who want him to do something differently. So in this next scene, we're going to see this kind of come to a head. So fast forward about 10 years, Manolo's all grown up, and now he's got his first bullfight in front of him. So let's watch what happens.
After years of training, Manolo's father organized his first bullfight, which, as luck would have it, was on the day that Maria returned.
Oh, yeah. Papa!
Playing all night with those mariachi brothers? You want to end up like those bozos?
Okay, Manny. Oh, we'll wait outside.
I don't think Mr. Sanchez likes us.
Yeah, Finn?
Quiet, you lazy bums. You live under my roof. You live under my rules. You will be a matador.
Papa, this is my life.
All the Sanchezes are bullfighters. Every single one of us.
I was a beast in the arena. A beast.
It's in your blood. It's your destiny. How many times do I have to say it?
This is not me. This is you.
Ah, oh, my son. Joaquin may be the hero of the town, but today you will be the hero of the ring. If, for once, you actually finish the bull.
But he finished the bull the other day in practice!
Vengatoro!
That did not count.
No. Killing the bull is wrong.
Here we go again.
Hi, kids today, with their long hair and their no-killing stuff.
I'm out of here.
Don't you love your family? Then go get that bull, mijo. Don't dishonor our name. Just be a Sanchez.
Mijo. He no gonna do it.
Manolo!
No retreat.
No surrender.
The hero of San Angel returns.
Oh, come on. You didn't think I was gonna miss your first little bullfight, did you?
And Maria's here too.
Have you seen her? I cannot wait to show her these babies.
Oh, so she's back only to see you.
Come on, that's
you
not...
have your medals, but I have the bull ring. We'll see which Maria prefers.
It's a good thing you're finally taking bullfighting seriously.
You should see me in the bull ring. That's where I really do my thing now. A true Sanchez man.
Those are some big shadows we live under, huh, buddy?
Huge.
So there it is. The fundamental conflict of the movie, the Book of Life, and I would also argue the fundamental conflict of living a life. That is how do we make peace with those tensions of those shadows and of our past? Right now, for Manolo and Joaquin and Maria, the shadows are from a family and a culture that expects so much of their children. But I think for some of us in here today, it's maybe a little bit more the case that our shadows are not so much that our parents expected so much of us, but maybe that our parents expected too little of us. Maybe they never told us that we were worthy of love or showed us that we were capable of doing great things with our life. And so we're kind of burdened with this long shadow of maybe inferiority. For others of us, maybe the shadow takes the form of the memories of maybe kids who made fun of us in school, or the coworkers or bosses who undermined and belittled us. And for others of us, maybe it's spouses who abused us, beat us up verbally or physically, right? And maybe it's even something that you were born with, physical and mental limitations, right? You are too short, too tall, too fat, too skinny. And all this is casting a long shadow. And I can say I have one of those shadows in particular. So when I was growing up, I was freakishly small. In fact, it was almost an oxymoron to say growing up because I didn't, right? I mean, when I was in eighth grade, I was literally, no exaggeration, the average height and weight of a second grader. And I know that because my parents were like, something's going on. And so they went and had me tested. After a bunch of tests, the doctors figured out that my pituitary gland wasn't producing any growth hormone. And so it had basically been asleep at the wheel for the last 10 years. So on top of this, as luck would have it, my family moved every few years. And so every few years, I got to hear the same jokes recycled from a new crop of kids. I got to pretend like I didn't notice people pointing and snickering out of the corner of my eye. And worse yet, I got to pretend like I didn't notice people looking at me and shaking their head in pity. And this wasn't just for a couple years. This is pretty much from kindergarten all the way until I was a junior in high school. And when I moved to these new schools, people would literally think I got lost somewhere between kindergarten and recess, you know, nap time. And here I wound up in the high school. So I know what it's like to have these kinds of shadows. And on top of that, when you have the potential of getting made fun of when you're a kid, what do you do? Well, you make sure that somebody else is always the butt of your jokes. So I also got really good at insulting people, at really figuring out what's going to hurt them and then just going right for the gut to make sure that everybody else was laughing at them instead. So I have that shadow too. I have the shadow of the knowledge that people out there are wounded and scarred because of things that I did, choices that I made, and words that I said. So whatever your issue is, whatever your challenge was growing up, whatever your challenge was in your household, we all live under shadows. But in spite of the enormous pressure and influence that these shadows exert on us, the fact remains that our past can never determine our future, because our past can never dictate our choices. I want to watch this next scene, and I want to have you think about that and see how Manolo handles this. I think it's a beautiful illustration of this point, that our past can never dictate our choices. So let's watch this scene.
And they say Manolo might be the greatest Sanchez ever!
Yeah, that's my boy! What?
I would like to dedicate this corrida to Miss Maria Posada.
Welcome home, senorita.
I'm allergic to dying!
Especially in the face!
Venga, Torote, venga!
Now that's a Sanchez!
Manolo! Wow!
That's my son! Yeah!
Come on, mijo. For me, for our family, Villa Sanchez.
The point, right, is that although we often can't choose our shadows, we can't choose our past, we can't choose our circumstances, we can't choose the family that we were born into, we nevertheless always have the ability to make a choice about how we respond, right? So even though we're never free from fate, we're always free to respond to fate. And we can never change that, right? And this is the revolutionary idea that was put forth by a young psychiatrist named Viktor Frankl back in the 1930s. And the first time I watched The Book of Life, I couldn't help but be struck by the similarities between this story and the story, the life and the work of Viktor Frankl. And see, Frankl was a student of Sigmund Freud, and so he was sort of trained in that kind of dissecting people's past to help them get over their mental illnesses. But what he found, what he discovered is that even after he'd helped them discover their Oedipus complexes and resurface the repressed tragedies of their past, these people didn't get better. They might have had a moment of catharsis, but they didn't change anything, right? Their health still wasn't any better. But what Frankl actually determined was if you show these same people, anxiety-ridden, severely depressed people, suicidal in many cases, if he showed them what meaningful choices they were still free to make, regardless of what happened in their past, right? The work that only they could do, the family and the siblings and the friends that only they could love in this unique and special way, all of a sudden, they got better. They understood that no matter what had happened to them, they were still free to respond in a meaningful way to their circumstances. Right? And that's the kind of choice that we just saw Manolo make here. Even though there were consequences to his choice, he got bonked in the head with a guitar and everyone booed him and his family was disappointed in him, he still nevertheless had the freedom to choose what he did, to follow his conscience. Now, Manolo, however, was only human in that sort of animated wooden doll kind of way. And so in this next scene, we're going to see how he lets go of that freedom, right? After Maria and Manolo express their love to each other, Maria gets bitten by a snake and dies, and Manolo is overcome with despair, and he kind of gives up his freedom to choose his fate. So let's watch this next scene.
I can't offer you a ring. I have nothing to give but my love.
Oh, Manolo.
I may not be the town hero, Maria, but I swear with all my heart, I will never, ever stop loving you.
And I will never stop loving the man who plays from the heart. Snake!
No! Maria!
What did you do, Manolo?
There was a snake and...
She's gone.
Why didn't you protect
Maria.
Her?
Maria! Oh, no! Oh, no! This is all you're doing! Leave, or so help me! My little girl. What have you done, boy? What have you done?
It should have been me.
Yes, it should have.
No! Maria died?
That can't be right!
What kind of story is this? We're just kids!
As the sky cried with rain, Manolo went back to retrieve his guitar.
I will never see her again.
Are you certain? You want to see Maria again?
With all my heart.
Think about what you say, boy.
With all my heart.
Done?
Maria.
I think one of my favorite parts of this movie is that Kelly Bundy is the one narrating the story to the little kids. But so in true Romeo and Juliet tragic romance fashion, Manolo gives in to his despair, right? He's overcome by grief and hopelessness, and he lets himself be bitten by the snake. But the only problem is Maria wasn't actually dead. She was just in a trance, sort of a temporary coma. And so now we've got Manolo in this situation where Maria, he thinks, is dead, but he himself is dead, so he's lost her. He's disgraced his family, and basically he's embraced his freedom to choose, and it's all just blown up in his face. And here again, I think there's a great parallel to Viktor Frankl's story. So let's fast forward now. So Frankl began as a prodigy, young psychiatrist in the early 30s, but now fast forward to 1942, and he's an Austrian Jew living in Vienna when the Nazis come in. And because of his status as kind of this renowned doctor, he has a visa to come to the United States, but he's faced with this dilemma. His whole family doesn't have a visa. And so he decides that he has a responsibility, a duty to his family, to his parents, to stay in Vienna with them and support them in whatever way he can. Well, after a few months, after he made this decision, he and everyone he loves is sent off to Nazi death camps. Over the course of the next 3 years, his mother, his father, his only brother, his only sister, his wife, his unborn child that she was carrying, all of them die in the camps. So while he's there, all that's taken from him. The day he shows up, his life's work, the book he was working on, was taken from him, right along with the shirt off his back. Over the next 3 years, he's going to experience starvation, sickness. 29 out of every 30 people that he's going to meet in the camps will die in the camps. And yet he survives. And when the war is over, he now has a decision to make about what does he do next? Right? He's experienced the most unimaginable suffering that any of us could ever could ever fathom. So what does he do next? Well, on the one hand, he sort of looks at his situation, and if we look at this next diagram, it kind of looked like this. He had this enormous loss, right? Everything he knows and loves, as soon as he gets out, he discovers it's all been taken from him. And so you wouldn't necessarily blame him for succumbing to despair at that point and saying, I've been telling all my patients, you have the freedom to choose and respond to fate, but this is more than I ever imagined. But he doesn't. He looks at it, and he says, he sees the situation in this way. If we look at the next diagram, in spite of the fact that he's lost everything, he recognizes that there's still areas of freedom in his life, areas of in which he can still choose to do things, right? So his the practice of medicine is not gone. His love for philosophy still exists. He still has the potential to meet another wife, to have another child, right? All these things, his theory, his knowledge, his experiences, none of that can be taken from him. Now, what I think is probably most interesting about this is that he came to this conclusion not in spite of being in the concentration camps, but because of it. So what he concluded was, although we always have limitations in our life, we also always have freedom within our limitations, no matter what, right? So we might be experiencing job loss, the death of a loved one, inoperable cancer, any kind of suffering you can imagine, there still is freedom to choose what you do with that, how you respond to your suffering. And that's what he learned from his fellow prisoners in the concentration camps. He saw that that even though many of them were facing certain death, they nevertheless responded to their suffering bravely and compassionately. Right? They would, rather than rat out some of their prisoners who had tried to steal some food so they could fill their belly for a change, they would rather face consequences, face the suffering and the punishment themselves. They would give up some of their own minuscule food rations for the sick patients, even though they themselves were dying of starvation. Right? They were manifesting what Frankl called the defiant power of the human spirit, that no matter what's going on with us physically or mentally, we always have this power of the spirit, right? We always have the power to claim what he called the last of the human freedoms, which is the freedom to choose our attitude in any circumstances. And that can never be taken from us. So we see in some ways, that's what Manolo is doing. Now, when I was studying this, I had kind of a crazy thought. And I started thinking, you know, I wonder if this is maybe what Jesus was talking about, this whole triumphing over your suffering. I wonder if that's what Jesus was talking about when he said, those who love their lives will lose it, and those who give their lives for me will be saved. Now, I've always found this confusing. One, we know it's important because it's in all four of the Gospels. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all decided to say some variation of this. But at the same time, I look at it and I think it doesn't make any sense. Right, if you lose your life, that's the very definition of not being saved, isn't it? So then you start thinking, well, maybe Jesus wasn't talking about our physical bodies. Maybe he wasn't even talking about the afterlife, heaven and hell. Maybe what he was talking about is, if you love your life, you'll lose it. In other words, if you are willing to throw other people under the bus just to save your own skin, if you give up your bravery, your courage, and your compassion, just because you're so scared of dying, so scared of suffering, so scared of losing money, or whatever your thing is, then you've lost the only part of you that was human to begin with. And so for all practical purposes, you're dead already. On the other hand, if I decide to face my circumstances and my suffering bravely and compassionately, then I have the opportunity to experience the ultimate triumph, which is the triumph over the fear of death, over the fear of suffering, the fear of losing all my money, the fear of not being liked, the fear of having people look down on me. Once I conquer that fear, now I'm finally free to truly live in the most human way possible. Now, fortunately for our man Manolo, The Book of Life is just a movie, and so he gets a second chance. He sees that there's a loophole. On the Day of the Dead, the ruler of the Land of the Remembered can grant him a second chance at life. But first he has to pass a test, an almost impossible test. He has to fight and win against every bull that his family has ever fought. Okay? Now, in this last scene, we're going to see that a bunch of the bulls, they've come together and they've all swirled together into one gigantic, monstrous beast that Manolo has to fight and win against. And if he defeats this bull, then he gets to go back up to see Maria and possibly save his town from the evil bandit Chacal. So let's see what Manolo does here.
Time to finish this.
I am humbled, for tonight I understand. Your royal blood was never meant to decorate this sand. You've suffered great injustice, so have thousands before you. I offer an apology, and one long overdue. I am sorry, Toro, I am sorry. Hear my song. And now I sing the truth. Although we were bred to fight, I reach for kindness in your heart tonight. And if you can forgive, and if you can forgive, love can truly live. And if you can forgive, and if you can forgive, love can truly live. And if you can forgive, and if you can forgive, love will truly.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, I'll give him that.
But how did Manolo do this?
He's a Sanchez.
Manolo took a stand. And even though he dearly respects and loves his family, and his heart aches to get back to Maria, he nevertheless recognized that he had the freedom and the responsibility to listen to his conscience and claim and assert his humanity. Right? And so with his actions, what he says is, the killing of the bull stops with me. The unwillingness of Sanchez men to apologize stops with me. And I think in a lot of ways, I think that's what God is telling us too. Right? Don't we, with God's help, don't we all have that same ability, right? That that with God's help, we can take a stand, that regardless of what has happened to us, regardless of the situation that we find ourselves in, don't we still have the freedom to choose what we do from this day forward, to step up and say, the generations of abuse and addiction in my family stop with me. Right? Everyone making fun of that kid at school because he's a little different stops with me. All right, my family's pattern of spending more money than we make stops with me. The cycle of poverty and racial injustice in my community stops with me. The debilitating belief in my own helplessness in spite of my circumstances stops with me. And not because we're any less worthy of love or respect if we don't stop these things, but simply because we're free to. We have the ability and the choice. We've been given a second chance to do this, to be redeemed. And so if we choose to, if we make that choice, claim our freedom, then we can say, you know what? I can make a better life, a better family, a better world in some small way start with me right here today with the choice I make. I want to close with a little prayer, if you wouldn't mind praying with me. God, thank you for, in your own way, wherever you are, whatever you are, thank you for tirelessly trying to set us free. No matter how many times I ignore it or dismiss it or scoff at it or intellectualize it, thank you for stubbornly refusing to stop trying to tell me in a parade of songs and movies and books and friends and strangers over and over again every single day that we don't have to be slaves to our past. Amen.